Good morning.
Good morning.
Christianity is a faith built on stories. And I think you know that. We just heard a beautiful story from John Gall about the history of the parish, and you have a tradition of telling these stories of the parish. Researchers have been telling us in recent years that the human mind is hardwired for stories. Stories are how we make sense of the world and how we make sense of our lives. So it follows that our faith is built on stories. The Gospels are chock full of them. It would seem that not only are we asked to know these stories, but we're supposed to tell stories. As people of faith, we are to tell our stories of faith. Eric Partridge, in his book on English etymology, reports that the word gospel and its related term, Godspell, are antecedents to the verb gossip, to gossip. And to gossip comes from the verb to see God. To gossip, to tell stories, is to see God. Kathleen Norris, in her book, Dakota, notes that the noun gossip comes from the words God and Sib for sibling. So together, God, Sib, was someone who was an especially familiar acquaintance, a close friend, someone you told confidences to, someone you might invite to attend a birth, or someone you might invite to be present at your death. A gossip is an intimate. I've come to the conclusion then that our gospels are gossip about Jesus, and we are meant to be gossips. Now, frankly, I know we will never be able to reframe our popular meaning of the word gossip back to its original intent. But as people of faith, we have daily opportunities to tell stories of our faith and to take on that storytelling or that holy gossip as a spiritual practice. So today I'd like to explore with you this theme of storytelling or gossip as spiritual practice. Part of today's gospel reading, that part about the little girl, was my favorite Bible story as a child. I still remember having a little book of Bible stories compiled for children, and I read that story, that one-page story, over and over again. On the facing page was a picture of a girl, a little bit older than I was. I was about 8 when I started reading this story. And that little girl was depicted with brown hair. I liked the story because I saw myself in it. I could identify with that little girl. Let me tell you, though, I certainly was never complacent when I read that story. It scared the bejeebers out of me. I sat on the edge of my chair each time I read it. After all, this girl died, and she was brought back to life. I still like reading that story in part because I remember how I felt as a child. But I hear it differently now. I now identify with the parents. I find that brash announcement of the girl's death rather harsh. And now, as an adult, I identify with different figures and take different lessons of faith and hope from it. Good stories are like that. We can grow and mature with them. They bring in the listener by giving them opportunities to identify with characters in the story. They have depth and complexity that allow us to grow and change over time. And they have sufficient variety of perspectives to bring in many different people. The Gospels and Scripture are just some of the stories that allow us to see God. Our own lives are filled with gospels, and it's our job as people of faith to share these gospels. So today I'd like to tell you a story that's important to me, and it's a story about St. Francis of Assisi. So I brought in a picture that I keep on my desk. Not as many animals as the picture that Reverend Gentrell had, but there are little birds in the side, And you can see, if you look at it closely, that he is praising all of creation. It makes sense for us to talk about Francis of Assisi today. We live, or at least we worship, in the city dedicated to St. Francis. Next Saturday, October 4th, is the feast day of Francis. Many churches, you'll notice, have pet blessings to commemorate Francis of Assisi. A little bit less known is a commemoration that takes place in Franciscan circles on October 3rd. So on Friday, if you pass by a Franciscan church, let's say St. Boniface over in the Tenderloin, you'll notice that they'll have a commemoration called the Transitus in the evening. This is a liturgy that commemorates the passing of Francis from this life to the next. Francis of Assisi is one of those figures who appeals to a wide variety of people for many different reasons. I've been a great admirer of Francis since I was a child. So the gospel I share of his life really touches on my own gospel story. As a child, I loved hearing the stories about Francis and the animals, and I particularly loved seeing bird baths with statues of Francis. My family didn't have a bird bath. My godparents had a bird bath, and I loved going over there to see the birds with the statue of Francis. Perhaps it's quaint, but I have a very fond memory of looking at this figure of Francis as someone who appreciated all creatures. As a young adult, I still loved those stories about Francis and the birds, Francis and the animals, but a different story resonated with me. I especially appreciated how Francis rebelled against his parents. He didn't take up the life that his parents had planned for him. His parents wanted him to become a merchant, to take up the family business, to prosper, to travel, to marry, to have children. Francis said, "No, I'm on a different path." And as painful as it was for his parents to hear, he renounced their plan for him and took up a spiritual life of poverty, giving up all the material comforts of his life. That was the story I liked about Francis when I was about 20, 25. I still like it. But now that I'm middle-aged, a different story is resonating deeply for me. It's one that's not often told, especially outside of Franciscan circles. And I'll admit to you, I used to dismiss this story as merely a quaint story of a woman who bakes cookies. I hold that close to me because I used to reject this story, which I now consider significant and full of truths. The story I'd like to tell you is about Francis and a very special woman. Now, when we hear about Francis of Assisi and a woman, we usually think of Claire of Assisi. And in fact, if you were to Google the name Claire of Assisi, one of the images that comes up is this image. Do any of you recognize this? This is from the Lower Basilica of San Francesco in Assisi. And the most popular attribution is to say that this is Claire, because after all, what woman could possibly be close to Francis of Assisi? Well, in fact, current research is moving away from that identity. And it seems that this could possibly be a woman named Jacoba de Sedeso, Lady Jacoba. How many of you have heard of Lady Jacoba? A couple of you, especially someone who's taken my class and someone in a Franciscan circle. Okay. Lady Jacoba is someone I'd like to ask all of us to reflect on this week. She was a very popular woman in her own time in the 13th century. She was powerful and wealthy and well-connected. She came from the family De Setesuli, of the seven sons. And I'd like to point out that there are seven sons in the halo of this figure. So perhaps this isn't Claire of Assisi, but perhaps this is an image of Jacoba de Sedesuli. Jacoba did what many aristocratic young women did. She married a well-connected and powerful man. But that's not why she became well-known. She's important for understanding Francis of Assisi because she is the person he wrote to requesting her presence when he lay dying. For a moment, reflect. Who would you ask to be at your bedside when you're dying? It's an intimate. Most likely, it's someone who's very close to you, very important to you, someone who you share much of your life with, much of your spiritual self with. This is who Francis of Assisi asked to be at his bedside. Not a priest to say confession. There were friars attending him, but he specifically asked for Jacoba. And what have we done with her story? We've forgotten it. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about her and connect it to Francis because their lives were so intertwined. She was a powerful woman from a powerful family who married into a very wealthy, well-connected, politically motivated family, the Frangipani. And she was expected to be part of this power structure. She lived in Rome, which was a city rife with civil discord, lots of civil wars. And in fact, her husband's grandmother, who she would have known and met, and perhaps would have been held up as a role model for her, took to the streets and battled side by side with her son and grandson. She was throwing rocks, throwing spears. This was the role model for Jacoba to follow. Very strong and assertive family. She was expected to display her wealth and power in how she dressed and who she connected with, who she spoke with. She did her family duty by bearing children. She had two sons. But soon, probably by the time she was 30 at least, she became a widow. She lost her husband. And as widowhood often does, she moved into a time of transition. There was certainly pressure on her from her married family and her own parents to remarry, find another political connection. But she was a woman who knew herself. She decided not to remarry. Instead, she moved into a period of discernment. Perhaps she walked through the streets of Rome, and during one of these walks, she encountered a crowd of people. She couldn't tell what was happening, but she moved forward. And as she moved forward, she could tell someone was speaking to these people. Not in a strident way, not in a preachy way, but in a conversation. A man in the middle of this group, wearing ragged clothing, no shoes, was talking about his love of God, how he could see God in all of creation. In time, Jacoba and Francis became close friends. They obviously had lots of conversations in which they shared their faith with one another. He taught her about his faith. She taught him about her faith. She was a mother, after all. She worried about her sons. In her sharing of her concern, Francis understood a little bit more what he had put his parents through. And Francis told Jacoba about his own decisions, his own life journey. And Jacoba came to appreciate what her sons might be going through and how she might have been steering them in a way that wasn't comfortable for them. They became teachers to each other. We might say spiritual soulmates. So close were they that when he was on his deathbed years later, He wrote to her, asking her to come immediately. He dictated a note to be sent to Rome, asking her to bring candles, to bring a tunic, to bring a pillow. Bring the cookies you make, because I love those cookies. He dictated this note, but it was never delivered, because as he was dictating it, she intuited his need. Their connection was so close that she could tell she was needed in Assisi, hundreds of miles away. She discerned that what he needed was her presence. She packed with her retinue of soldiers to accompany her. She packed all of the things he had delineated in the letter. She brought candles. She brought a pillow for his head. She brought incense to sweeten the air of the room. She brought a tunic to clothe him in and a burial shroud to bury him in. And she brought all the ingredients to make the almond cookies that he loved. She arrived at the friary door, knocked on the door. Friars freak out. Women aren't allowed in the friary. Friar who answers the door doesn't know what to do. What should I do? What should I do? Francis says, let her in. She's who I want. She is who I want to be with me. She enters into the room and tends to him. Over the next few days, she keeps his body clean. She washes him. She comforts him with a cool compress on his head, gives him sips of water, prays with him. She makes the cookies, but knows he can't really eat them. She offers him a little bit. He tastes it and smiles. Most of all, she's present to him. She sits, holds his hand, and is present to his breath, and watches how his breath changes over those next few days. She keeps his hand in hers, keeps her thought on prayer, and notices his breath slowing down, notices the long gaps between each shallow breath. And when the time lengthens, she feels both peace and a little bit of anxiety. That little bit of, is this it? Is it happening now? She is the constant for him in those final days, and she is the person he requested to be with him. He does give his final breath, and a small tear falls out of her eye. And she knows he is with Christ. She stays with him for the next hour or so. And in time, after many prayers and much silence, she knows it's time to prepare the body for burial. She takes that task up herself, washes the body, puts the body in a shroud for burial. Takes care of all of the details for the funeral. She pays for the candles. She pays for the incense. She facilitates the liturgical setting. She is the one who is central to the death of Francis of Assisi. Not the other friars, not the Pope, not the Mistress General, to laywoman, whose faith was dependent on her being present. In time, she decides not to return to Rome, but retires to Assisi, where she never renounces her wealth. She doesn't give up her property and become a nun. She remains a steward of her property in order to support the friars and the Franciscans until she died. When she died, she was buried in the Church of St. Francis in Assisi and is the only layperson buried there. And yet it's often easy to overlook her grave as you walk down to the crypt to visit the tomb of Francis. And it's often easy to forget she ever existed because we forget to tell that story. That story of her gentle presence, and I think I'm going to even push it further and say her persistence to be present. When she knocked on the door, the friars weren't going to let her in. She knew her place was to be with Francis. This gospel of Jacoba and Francis is rich. You may take from this story some lessons that I have overlooked, and I'm eager to talk with you afterwards to hear what lessons resonate for you in this story. But for me, one of the most important lessons is how easily we can forget what Christian leadership looks like. Jacopa's life of Christian service was firmly planted in her station of life. She never renounced her wealth or her social prestige. As I mentioned, she never took vows to become a nun. Instead, she used her life to further the spiritual path that she honored. She also used her life to be present where she was needed. The details of her life from the 13th century are certainly different from our lives today. But on a spiritual level, her life remains important to us. She offered leadership by living her life fully. That is a gospel lesson that can resonate throughout the centuries, as long as we remember to tell it. So, as we enter into this week of Francis's feast day, along with the blessing of animals and the praying for all of creation, I invite us to spend a little time reflecting on Jacopa and her life of faith. And I invite each of us to reflect on the gospel of our own lives and then share this good news of seeing God with others. Thank you.